Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm your host, Joe Haddo, and I hope wherever you are in the world, you're staying safe and well. If you're listening via iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please do take a moment to rate and review Book Off, as it really helps us to spread the word. And if you're of the social media persuasion, then do give us a little shout out and say hello, because we always love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, at @odobookoff. In this episode, as always, I'm joined by two fabulous authors who'll be going head to head in a war of the words a little later on in our Book Off. They are former journalist and number one best-selling novelist Victoria Hislop. Hello and welcome to you.
Hello, lovely to be here with you.
Lovely to have you down the line, as we call it. And also joining us, former TV producer turned author Lissa Evans. Hello to you, Lissa.
Hello. Hello, very nice to be here.
It's great to have you both here. And it's great that you're already friends.
Yes.
We are.
Yeah, we see each other at the London Library and have sandwiches in the square. And it's always good to see Vic.
And I feel rather distant, because we haven't really been having our lunches for quite a few months, but they are incredibly helpful in a way, just a sort of feeling that you're not the only person in the world writing. And Lissa and I always have good chats, either in the sunshine or in the sort of cafe when it's the winter. So I can't wait for that to resume.
Yes, it's like being in an office and having office colleagues, if anyone can remember what that's like.
I think we've all forgotten what that's like. But I suppose what's interesting is authors don't have colleagues in the same way as others do. Obviously, there are teams behind publishing a book, and you work with your editor and your agent and everything. But to have a sort of fellow author and who you can have a lunch with and sort of bounce things off is probably really, really lovely, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain moments when I think we do bounce things off each other, obviously not the whole content of a book, but definitely things like book covers. And because quite a few of us have become this kind of little gang in the London Library down there near Piccadilly, you know, if you have a sort of first shot at a book cover from your publisher, that's definitely what we'll show while we're eating our sandwiches. You know, what do you think of this? And if, you know, 5 out of 6 people eating a sandwich together say, that's horrible, you know, well, it influences, you know, and book titles. I definitely remember with Lissa chatting about book titles. And, you know, it's a group that you trust, because they know the pros and cons of, you know, certain types of approach. And yeah, we are a bit of a team, and absolutely wonderful.
It's lovely. It's very supportive.
And I suppose, you know, everyone has an off day occasionally, and that's the same for writers. So if you're in one of those days where the words just aren't coming, or, you know, there's a bit of inspiration dam, then you know, just being able to talk to somebody who understands that is also a really helpful thing, isn't it?
It is, although Vic, I have to say, writes with such tenacity and speed and skill that actually the rest of us feel a little bit pathetic and flabby by comparison. Like,
come on, Lissa, that is true. I was actually looking up reviews of your past books, and everybody completely raves about your writing style, and nobody ever raves about my writing style. So I think in terms of writing style, I always think I can construct a sentence to say what I mean, but the actual prose, I think, you know, if we're having prose off as opposed to book off, I would definitely give my prize to Lissa. She writes absolutely beautiful.
This is turning into a back-slapping circle.
And nauseating to
listen to.
Your Lissa's biggest fan is my husband. I don't know, you probably got bigger fans, Lissa, but I watch him. He reads, pages are turning, tears are sprouting. Your books really touch him. So
I love that there's this camaraderie right now, and all this sort of respect and love for each other, because I've seen what Lissa's been writing on social media about the book off later on, and she's here to have a proper battle, Vic. So I think all these nice words are going to go out the window.
That's exciting.
I'm not convinced, as you'll find out later, that Vicky's actually beatable on this one. In a certain subtle way, she has cheated, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway.
Already, pre-battle, I'm accused of undermining the competition.
I told you. Good Lord, I told you this is going to turn nasty. And before it does, why don't we talk about your latest books? We're recording this in September. Lissa, your book's just come out, and Vic, your book's coming out in October, which is when this podcast will become available. So let's talk about One August Night to start with. You return to Crete for this book, and it's the long-awaited sequel to The Island. So what made you want to do that now?
Well, it was right at the beginning of lockdown, when we didn't really know how much time we had ahead of us. And the only thing that I absolutely knew was that I couldn't travel to Greece. You know, that was not going to happen.
And it's a place that you spend a lot of time in, isn't it? It's somewhere you go for...
It is. I spend a huge amount of time here, and especially when I'm obviously researching a book, because, you know, 90% of what I write is set in Greece. So I suddenly felt like, I mean, there's no possibility for me of writing a book set in the Kent countryside, which was where I found myself. I cannot do English characters. I can't persuade myself that they're remotely real, so I definitely wouldn't persuade a reader. And somebody had actually said, you know, what happened after, you know, the leprosy colony of Spinalonga, which is what The Island was about, shut in 1957, and then, you know, people had lives afterwards. And it was one of the few books I've written where I don't kill everybody off at the end. And I thought, actually, you know, quite a lot of the others are a little bit like Greek tragedies, you know, bodies on the stage. But with The Island, there was still this open-ended, you know, sense of, you know, what happened next, which I never imagined that I would go back to and pick up these threads. And, you know, lockdown was a very difficult time for everybody, I think. Life was just suddenly not remotely how it usually is. And I had these weeks stretching ahead, and I needed to keep myself, you know, in a routine, which we all know really mattered for those months. And I sort of did feel quite creative. And, you know, this is not meant to sort of jerk people's emotions, but my mother died at the beginning of lockdown, and The Island was dedicated to her. It was all very unexpected. So more or less on the 22nd of March, when I was just sort of thinking, I've got to get through this period, I began to write the sequel. And it, for me, was one of the most joyful writing experiences I've ever had, because I was literally drawing on my own imagination. There's no historical research in this one, so it makes it quite different from other books I've written. It's in a way, it's more pure character, and it's the characters of three men who are all affected by the death of Anna, who's shot at the end of the island. So I had a, gosh, really rather a wonderful time writing it, you know, sitting at my desk at nine, pretending actually that I was going to the London Library. There wasn't any sandwich with Lissa in my lunch hour, but I still had a routine, and that's what a lot of us enjoy about going to this library in London, is that it makes us think like we're going into an office. So one August night, the title comes from this night when Anna, in a way, the femme fatale, is shot by a jealous husband. And it's a night that changes the lives of every character. Whether or not they're a leprosy patient, this is a night that really sort of blows up a community and blows up the normal kind of sequence of life. And, you know, I found, you know, I followed these men who essentially... you know, their lives as they were end on that night, and I followed and saw where they went, and it was a little bit like I was watching the plot unfold. I didn't ever feel I was particularly in the driving seat, you know. I sort of rather, that's the excitement of being a writer. I don't know if it's a, I'm sure she'll have the same experience, you know. Characters totally take you by surprise, and you think you're going in one direction, and they say, actually no, I'm going to take a left turn here, and off they go up a different path and you follow them. So creatively, for me, it was a very satisfying 3 or 4 months, and it's going to press next week and coming out in October. So, you know, I hope readers who like The Island, because having never written a sequel, I don't know how people react to them. Maybe they go, oh, that's not what I thought would happen, and why did you do this? You know, I'm sure they'll have opinions, but we'll wait and see. But for me, it was, a very important book for me to write, because I feel I concluded the stories a little bit more than I had done in The Island itself. I feel like there was some sort of catharsis found for several of them, who were left slightly hanging, their fates were hanging in the air. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that fans of The Island will be, you know, will enjoy it first and foremost, and find it as page turning as, you know, I want them to.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We'll wait till October. Oh,
I think they will, Vic. Don't you worry about that.
Let's hope.
And speaking of sequels,
well, you couldn't have had a smoother segue, could we?
Yeah. Viva for Victory, which is your latest novel, is a sequel to Crooked Heart, is it not?
It is, and the third in a trilogy, and I certainly thought I'd never write a trilogy. I mean, it's quite a loose trilogy. You can read all of the books as standalone, but yes, it is. It specifically takes two characters who are at the heart of Crooked Heart, a boy called Noel and his sort of foster mother, V, and Crooked Heart is set in 1939 to 40, and it picks up again in 1944 to 45. It's a book about the end of the war, which I found an extraordinary thing to read about. I mean, I had done lots and lots and lots of World War II research before this. I've written two previous books set in that era, but I'm always terribly scrupulous about not knowing more than my characters, so I had never read anything specific about the end of the war until researching for this book. And I was really, although I knew the basic facts of the end of the war, about the rockets and the doodle bugs and so forth, I had never really realised what a horrendous 6 to 8 months it was. Everybody knew the Allies were going to win, but there was first of all doodle bugs, pilotless planes, and then there were rockets which would literally drop out of nowhere and with no warning whatsoever. If you heard it, you might still be alive. If you didn't, you know, it killed without warning. And thousands upon thousands of people died over about 6 months. And not only that was going on, but also rationing had hit terribly hard, but also it was the coldest winter within living memory. So it was the grimmest possible time, and everybody knew the end was coming, but they desperately firstly wanted it to come, but they also wanted to hope for something more hopeful in the future. So it was a really interesting time to write about, and fuel shortages, and oh gosh, it was tremendously dramatic and grim, but also it was a chance for me to pick up characters that I'd written before and whom I know now as well as my own family. I think, I don't know whether Vic feels the same, but it's
definitely better than
true. And so it was, yes, it was a pleasure to meet them again, it really was. Yeah
Well, I've got a question for both of you, really. I'll start with you, Lissa, which is about what draws you to your settings of a book. So for Vic, it's Greece, which I want to hear about. But for you, Lissa, you're obviously fascinated with this part of history, this Second World War time. What is it, do you think, that drew you to that in the first place, and that made you want to write, you know, more books about it?
Well, it's quite specific, really. I mean, when I was about 12 or 13, my big sister, who was a sociology student at the time, bought a book for my dad for Christmas called How We Lived Then, which is by Norman Longmate, which was detailed memories of by various people who had, there'd been advert places, you know, what are your memories of the Second World War? And also through diaries and letters, people remembering what it was like, the home front was like on an everyday basis. And my father looked at it rather wonderingly and said, why would I want to read this? I lived through it. And so he didn't read it, but I did. And I was absolutely fascinated by it. It wasn't a book. It wasn't a sociological treatise. Later books I've read about the Second World War have been much deeper in terms of the, you know, the social milieu and the psychology. This was simply what people ate, what went into Christmas stockings, what school was like, what where people went on holiday, what did you feed your pets. So it was absolutely fascinating, and I read and reread it and reread it. And so I sort of moved into adult life with a kind of baseline of knowledge about the home front, which I added to over the years. It always fascinated me. And so when I actually wanted to write a book set in the Second World War, which was about the making of a film, which turned into Their Finest Hour and a Half, I already had, if you like, memories of my own of it. So I had something to build on. I wasn't starting from scratch. And it's nearer that I now feel very comfortable in, though I wouldn't have wanted to live in it. But I sort of know what my characters are looking at. I know how they speak. I know what they want.
And Victoria, for you, you know, you said you just can't imagine writing British characters in the Kent countryside. So what do you know what it is that draws you to Greece for your novels?
Gosh, it's not really something particularly sort of intellectual response. It's a very emotional
<That's all right>.
response. Yeah, because I sort of just really resonated with me what Liz said about, you know, the domestic details from that period that she learnt through the book, you know, what's in people's Christmas stocking. I mean, that really ignites my interest as well. Those, you know, because so many historical books, even, you know, all books about the Second World War or most, are not about what it was like for a woman and the family and children. It's, you know, you can read any number of books about strategy of battle and war, and the same in Greece. Very easy to find books that detail, you know, let's say for the Civil War, which I wrote about recently, which army was where and what they were wearing. But I always think, well, what was it like for the women left at home? And I suppose my path into the sort of period in Greece that I write about, which is sort of 40s and 50s, 60s a little bit, is that Greece hasn't actually, in certain areas at least, certainly in Crete, hasn't fundamentally changed. You know, if you go up into a village in Crete, in the mountains, it could be any time between 1940 and 2020, even what the elderly ladies are wearing. So I suppose that's what's always fired me, is the sense that I can get close to history, in inverted commas, because history is almost still there, you know, domestic situations, the way people live, the way the old ladies here cook, have a donkey or a mule kind of loaded up with their firewood. You still see these things. So I always feel
like... Which is amazing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, they certainly in Crete, people live quite simple lives, a lot of them. They grow their own vegetables. They have a goat. You know, it's somehow in this recent period, one's been very envious of that because they didn't go to the supermarkets anyway, so they weren't going to find them emptied. You know, they've got their potatoes and everything already from their own kind of small holding. So I think for me, being able to write about the past in Greece isn't so difficult because it, the past and the present are somehow very fused here. You know, there's no big divide, for example, between the 20th century and the 21st. You see some amazingly clapped out old trucks around here, which I'm sure have been going for 40 or 50 years. So, but why Greece is a... I absolutely have no idea, Joe. It's one of those strange and wonderful things that happened to me back in 1977 when I first came here. And I just totally fell in love with Greece and come here, you know, have been coming ever since and find inspiration, which I don't really anywhere else. So, yeah, it just sort of delivers me ideas. Yeah.
Well, I love that, though, because I mean, not to turn it on to me, but I have a similar relationship with California and specifically with Los Angeles, because I went there when I was very young, but sort of old enough to appreciate it. But I was still in my teens and then lived out there for a few months. And I've sort of been going back, not every year, but I go back quite a lot. And it's just, what you're saying is it's similar to me. I find when I'm there, even though sometimes it's awful,
you feel you're at home, maybe.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I sort of feel like, it's like a sort of second home, and I feel very comfortable there.
Yeah, if you believe in reincarnation in any form whatsoever, you know, you feel perhaps you were there once. That's how I feel about Greece, that this is somehow I was... somehow once here, even if I was here as a plant or an ant. I think I've been here before.
A gecko on the wall.
That would be quite a nice life, actually.
I think I was the H on the Hollywood sign. Oh. I think that's what I was.
That's nice. Love that.
Lissa, you had, before you started writing, or certainly before you were first published, you, a bit like me, worked for Auntie Beeb in the radio side of things, but you also were involved in TV, in producing and directing some great shows. You did, what did you have a hand in? Room 101?
Room 101, I started for radio and then we moved to telly with it.
Did you work on Father Ted as well?
I did. I produced the second and third series, yes. I didn't do the first one. That was Geoffrey Perkins, who was kind enough to hand me the mantle when he became head of comedy at BBC. So yes, and the Kumars at number 42. That was another one of mine. So
yes, wow. Yeah. Fantastic.
So yeah, that was very lucky. Yeah.
I mean, it must be so great to have those, you know, shows that we still talk about that you kind of, that you know that you had a part in.
It is.
Go on. The reason for bringing it up, sorry, is that that's very much a sort of background in entertainment and comedy.
Yes.
And so I suppose I wondered if there was ever a time when you thought you would write more in that genre rather than, you know, historical fiction.
Funnily enough, no, really. I mean, I went into comedy because, like most people in comedy, because I love comedy. Yeah. But I started off in radio where, you know, you don't drift into comedy, you choose to go into comedy. But I started, you know, I did my, if you like, my apprenticeship in radio where all you have is words. I mean, you know, it's fatuous to say so, really, but you cannot think of a better place to learn editing. And it appealed to something in myself, but also it honed my skills of pruning things, of seeing where the joke is, of seeing the perfect line, of, you know, of shaping and of precision, all of things which are important in my own writing. And I think I always wanted to write prose. I've got notebooks going back to when I was five of things, stories I've written. But I do think that the dialogue is very important in my books. And I think having worked in dialogue and having worked in radio, that helped me to find how to write.
Yeah.
So I think
also in, you know, in whatever industry writers are in before, there is an influence there. And there's also skills that you don't necessarily know you're getting. For example, I guess, Victoria, in, you know, as a journalist, you learn about structure and you learn about, you know, how to get a point across quicker. And, you know, I guess it all helps play into the novel writing.
That was also true. But I worked in the probably the best training of all was being in PR, i.e. public relations. Yes. Which is the art of persuading people that something's true, and it's probably not.
That's very good.
So it's the greatest fiction of all. And that's what I did, because I had a sort of very, you know, unlike Lissa, who's got a much more, I mean, really good BBC credentials, which I think, you know, what she says about words, that's absolutely totally true. But I went from book publishing to PR, where I learned to kind of write fiction, really, and then into travel writing, which was good because I felt without having had the travel writing experience, I wouldn't have written that first book, because my initial thought was, oh, I'm going to write a travel article. And then I immediately thought, no, there's another layer here. There's almost a fusion of the PR, which is creating a story, and this real place, which obviously exists and still does. Yeah. So, yeah, I think we're both lucky to have, in a way, not because I couldn't, I'm sure Lissa would agree. Could you have written a novel, or do you think you'd still be writing novels now if you'd started at 21?
I mean, I did try to start at 21. I didn't have anything to write about. I didn't write a novel until I had something I really, really wanted to write about in the end. I don't think my style has changed hugely, but the stories that I've accumulated are the things that have changed.
Yes, I totally agree. I feel lucky not to have made some attempt maybe, you know, at 23, 25, because I think I was 40, late 40s probably when The Island, 45 when The Island came out. So, you know...
I was 41 when my first novel came out, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad of that, and yeah. So.
And I also think it's really good to talk about that, and for, you know, people listening who might be writing and or wanting to get published and thinking, oh God, you know, it's never going to happen. Well, actually, it's not all about the 20-somethings and the first novels. It's actually there is something about having life experience, and like you say, having a story to tell.
Well, we like to think so, don't we, Vic?
Definitely. we're like
20-something debut novelists.
you know when you buy a peach and it looks really nice, and then you try and stick your knife in this peach and it's just hard as a rock. I think we're like the right peaches in the bowl. We're like lovely,
just on the turn,
kind of nice sweet fruit. You know, you've got to eat us now. Oh gosh, you can't take this analogy too far, can we?
No, you've got to be careful.
Yeah, there are various stages of fruit, and I feel, you know, lots of young writers probably feel very
cheese.
Maybe
I'm thinking
disappointed.
Cheese, maybe.
A nice Stilton. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, very good. Yes.
It's really, really smelly and mouldy. No, we can't go down there either.
But yeah, you've got plenty of time in your life to write. And oddly enough, it's something that you can do, as we know from writers even older than us, is that people go on writing into their 80s and writing brilliantly. You know, how old is John le Carré? I'm not sure, but he's definitely older than us. And, you know, isn't it great? You can do it sitting down or when you're still young enough to, you know, run the marathon. It can be a really good career for the slightly more ageing.
Mature.
Yes, exactly.
Good word. Very good. Yes. And I have to say, Vic, that next to being a food critic, I think travel writing is one of my dream jobs, you know. That must have been fun.
Yes, it was. I mean, I was sent to China and South America and India. I mean, really, and Australia once to review health farms. I'm afraid I would drop everything, you know. And I was asked to ride over the Andes on a horse in the footsteps of Bruce Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I was off. You know, I picked up my job because I used to ride a lot. So I was often given these rather jolly gigs that you needed not only a travel journalist, but someone who could ride a horse.
The great outdoors, the adventure.
Oh, and that was amazing. I mean, even if someone rang me while we were recording this programme and offered me something, you'd probably just hear, you know, the line would go dead. I'd be off. So, yeah, they were very exciting things. All sorts of mad adventures like white water rafting and, the riding things, which were extremely exciting. But I haven't done it for a long time. I've slightly been too busy.
It says wistfully. Writing. Still available.
Still available for exciting horseback riding, ideally in warm countries.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, it's time for the book off now. And as I said earlier, this is where each of you is going to tell us about a book that you love that you think we should all read, and you're going to get 3 minutes each to do so. We'll come on to that very shortly, but I'm actually keen just to talk about what you've both been reading recently, if indeed you've found time to read. I know that certainly in lockdown a lot of people sort of couldn't concentrate enough on fiction, or didn't quite have you know, their usual reading prowess, but it's always good just to hear what's been on your to be read piles recently and what you've enjoyed. Lissa, is there anything that springs to mind that you've been reading recently?
Yeah, it took me a long time to get back into reading. I must admit, I did a lot of rereads at the time. But the book I've read two books recently that I really loved. One, a current book called Small Pleasures by Claire Chambers, which is a really terrific book set in the 1950s. Beautifully, beautifully written. I'm not saying anything about it, actually, but fans of Barbara Pym particularly would adore it. And I also read a book by Molly Panther Downs, who was a writer during the 40s, called One Fine Day, which does sort of what Mrs. Dalloway does. It's basically one character and one day, but I find Mrs. Dalloway quite hard work, whereas this one I thought was completely wonderful. It's set in 1946, and it's about life after the war. It's about the changes in life. It's about re-establishing a routine when one person in a relationship's been away for a long time. It's set in the Downs, and I thought it was completely fantastic. So One Fine Day by Molly Panther Downs, that was my favourite.
Fantastic. And what about you, Vic?
Well, it's a book that I think more people would enjoy, but it has never really kind of reached the right audience, I think. And it's by a French writer called Virginie Despont, who is enormous in France. You know, they chop down trees to publish her. And she's written this trilogy called Vernon Subutex, which is the name of the main character. And he's a really, truly dreadful individual who sort of more or less lives on the streets of Paris and hangs out with, you know, terrible ex-rock stars and prostitutes and drug takers and all sorts of ne'er-do-wells. And it's completely outside my comfort zone, this book. It's like I'm looking through a little peephole to see what really goes on in the kind of darker areas of Paris. But it's totally gripping, and I got very kind of caught up in this character, because there's no way you could... He's an anti-hero, this Vernon, and there's no way you'd ever want to meet him. You don't admire him, but you can't help being absolutely in awe of how badly he behaves.
What's the first book called, Vic?
Well, they're all called Vernon Subutex, which is his name, C-U-B-U-T-E-X, and there's sort of volumes 1, 2, and 3, and you follow his fate. And I think it's published by McElhose Press, which is part of, you know, Hachette, I think, translated by somebody called Frank Wynne. And heaven knows how he's managed to translate all this slang and swearing and kind of French idiom, you know, which you might think is untranslatable, but he's done a brilliant job. And you kind of go down into the sort of the depths of, you know, French, kind of the underworld, if you like. Anyway, outside, generally, the opposite of Jane Austen, I would say, if one had to kind of think of how you describe it.
It's a great strapline.
And then that would probably have sold it better, actually, because it really should be. I think a lot of young people would love it if they discovered it. And a more kind of comfort read, which I reread, was the sort of David Nichols' Sweet Sorrow, because I found a very
lovely book.
Touching, lovely book that, again, different members of the family can read and all discuss and enjoy together. So it's not just a book for somebody of my age, you know, 20-year-olds absolutely love it too. And he does write, I think, with just great warmth about emotion, and he really gets people. So I'm a big fan, but I enjoyed the sort of comfort of rereading that again.
Yes, it's that's sort of a perfect book to have picked up over the last few months, isn't it? Just to, get away from everything else.
Yeah, because reading so hasn't always been the default activity, I think, during lockdown. It could have been, but I think sometimes our minds weren't sort of rested enough to read. But let's hope.
No, exactly.
We'll all start living more normally.
Yes.
So those are my two recent reads.
Well, thank you very much for those. And let's get on to now the book off, the main event, and find out which books you're putting forward. So before we decide who goes first, who goes second, Lissa, what book are you putting forward for the book off today?
I'm putting forward The Shipping News by Annie Proulx.
Fantastic. And what about you, Vic?
Well, Lissa's already said I've won, apparently.
No, I've hinted that you have chosen an unfair advantage.
Okay. I've chosen War and Peace by Tolstoy.
Which I've heard of, I think.
Well,
terrible pressure on the host.
The problem is we've all heard of it, but not everybody has read it, and I was one of them.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, it's like the most famous title in the world, but I don't know how many copies are read every year. Anyway.
Well, this is true. And we're gonna find out exactly why you've chosen it in just a moment. Victoria, would you like to go first or second?
I'll leave that to Lissa.
Oh!
I'll defer to you, Lissa.
I'll go second. I'll go second.
Okay, then you can... Kind of really,
she wants to see what she's up against.
Really, yes, parry the blows. Okay.
Victoria's so eloquent. I'll have to, you know, sharpen my claws. Yeah,
I'm just going to talk. I've got to talk really fast so I can get the whole book into 3 minutes. I'm going to gabble like a sort of racing, horse racing commentator.
Yes, you have 3 minutes and you don't have to use them all, but As the 3 minute mark approaches, I will either be honking you or ringing you with the school bell. Yeah. So, as Lissa got to choose first or second, Vic, would you rather be rung out or honked out?
I think, using those expressions, definitely rung out. I'll be rung out.
It's not as bad as another episode of, when I said, would you rather have the bell or the horn, which sort of really changed the tone of the whole thing.
Okay.
So the bell for you.
Yes, please. Is that what you said? Like a little school bell. Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock then, and it's over to you, 3 minutes uninterrupted, Vic, to tell us about Tolstoy's War and Peace.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's important that you read the right translation, and the right one is Anthony Briggs, which is the most recent 2005 in Penguin Classics, and it's so fluent. It reads like something that was written 5 years ago. Very, very sort of... gosh, just it flows, the pages turn. And there are 1,300 pages, definitely the longest book I've ever read, but one of the most deeply satisfying and moving of anything I've ever held in my hands. And like many of us, I've resisted reading it for my whole life, i.e. 61 years, with all sorts of excuses. I imagined thousands of impossible names, and in fact, there are no more than the average Thomas Hardy, and probably only half a dozen that really matter. Pierre, André, Helen, Sonia, Natasha, they're not so difficult, really. Second excuse, of course, was the length of it. When would I have the time? Well, lockdown dispensed with that excuse, and I've never read a book that remotely competes with it for character development, suspense, humour, not something I imagined, great writing, and the warmth and understanding of the human condition. There's love, loss, sex, death, politics, the personal, there are battlefields, religious visions, scandal, and Tolstoy interweaves history with fictional characters. So I even learnt about Napoleon and his invasion of Russia, which I would never have picked up a history book to read about. So you see how everything looks. It's like watching a film, from the glorious clothes worn by women at a ball in St. Petersburg to the landscapes and even the exact colour and texture of a dog's fur. He just gives you everything. Then there are the passages where he steps outside the narrative and gives you his views on fate and how history actually unfolds, which I found really fascinating. He talks about how history is often random and isn't shaped by the decision of big political figures. So there's sort of philosophy there as well. And this isn't a plot spoiler, but all the way through, I wondered if he'd hit us with a sudden tragic event, but the ending is a happy one, and it's quite nice to know that. And the only tears I cried at the end were because I was genuinely sad to have finished this wonderful journey, this epic journey that I went on with Tolstoy. It took me about 3 months. I was sorry to leave behind Pierre, Natasha, Anya, Sonia, all the rest, but the person I really was sad to leave behind was the voice of Tolstoy. And it was the most wonderful reading experience. I read it in a book group of two with my 27-year-old son, and we both, what's rather wonderful is that it's obviously a book not just for elderly people like me, but for younger people as well, because... I think I said everything I wanted to.
I think, yep, that was really great. Really great, yes. You can have a breather now, Vic.
Oh, lovely. Relax. Glass of water.
Yes, have a glass of water.
Cold
very,
shower.
Very, very
cold
good.
Shower, yeah.
And I could tell you could have gone on for at least another minute.
Oh, yeah, I could have gone
for
1,300.
Sorry to cut you down.
1,300 minutes
your prime.
I could have done. But, yeah.
I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock then, and it's over to you now, Lissa.
I've just gone home. I've left. No point in me staying here. I was going to go down and make a cup of tea.
Not at all. I believe you're going to rise to the challenge.
That was beautiful.
3 minutes on the clock then to tell us about the shipping news by Annie Prell.
Right. I've chosen the shipping news. And I think I read this book for the first time not too long after it was published in about 1993. And since then, I think I've reread it 5 or 6 times. It's got everything for me that a book should have. It's wonderfully and distinctively written. It's satisfying. It's vivid. It's funny, moving. The characters are not those you usually encounter in fiction, and yet they're utterly believable. And it has an incredibly strong sense of place. And though the narrative arc is quite straightforward, it's stuffed with stories within stories, so that when you get the end of it and look back, you can't quite see the whole of the road that took you there. And that means there are still surprises on the second and third reading. It's an alternative to writing a very, very long book, for instance. And chapter one begins, I wrote this bit down. Here is an account of a few years in the life of Coyle, born in Brooklyn and raised in a shuffle of dreary upstate towns. And the opening chapter is quite a sort of jolting read for a first timer, because it's a sort of rapid run through this man Coyle's early life, and it's written in a very choppy style with short sentences and broken clauses, and these build up a sort of vivid picture of a man who can't find his place in life, who's always standing awkwardly on the margins. He's only half understanding, or half hearing what people are saying, and Coyle is described as having a great damp loaf of a body, head shaped like a Crenshaw, no neck, reddish hair ruched back, features as bunched as kissed fingertips. A Crenshaw's a melon, by the way, I looked it up. And he's got a huge chin as well. And he's awkward, and he's unhappy, and he's exploited by everyone he meets. And this culminates in a terrible marriage to Petal, who despises him while he worships her. And then, this is only at the end of chapter two, she dies in an accident. She leaves him with 2 small children. And for the first time in his life, he takes the initiative and he moves his family 1,000 miles to Newfoundland, which is the home of his forebears, which is a lump of rock in a wild sea, the harshest of environments. But it's a place where, to his surprise, for the first time in his life, he seems to fit in. And he's accompanied in the journey by someone I think is one of the great characters in 20th century fiction. Agnes Ham, she's called, and she's his father's sister, and she's only ever known in the narrative as the aunt. And she's dry and fierce and practical, and she's a woman who's fought back against an awful childhood and found life and love, and is now returning to exercise old memories in the place where she grew up. So that's the sort of central hinge of the plot, but there's so much else in the book. It's stuffed with characters and interlinking stories. It's with the practicalities and the problems of Coyle's domestic life, and with the office politics, the terrible Newfoundland local newspaper that employs him, and with sea law and with history. There we go.
I think it sounds brilliant.
I do love it.
Does,
yeah,
it?
I can't help making a comparison between this Coyle and Pierre Bezukhov in War and Peace, who's
awkward.
Also,
yeah,
kind of,
yeah,
damp. I mean, you would say the damp loaf of a body, Lissa, is so great, isn't it?
But it's that, very good. He's a big man, isn't he, Pierre?
You imagine, oh, Pierre has a damp loaf, and also marries this woman, Helene, who sort of,
oh yes,
lets him down and
leads
dies,
him a dance,
and
yes,
dies,
yes, yes.
Leads him a dance,
good point,
and then dies. Yeah, so
that's a good point.
Wonderful. I'm not saying that there's any plagiarism going on here, but I love feeling that there are these, it's these flawed people like Coyle and Pierre, who are so
those are the ones
real
you
and mind. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. God, I really want to read it, and I never have, Lissa. I'm really...
Oh, well, good. Oh, good.
Yeah,
I mean, I have read War and Peace, so I have
to admit... Of course
I've
you
read,
have.
Read, well, no, years ago. I mean, gosh, when I was about
everybody
20,
had,
I read
except
it.
Except me. I mean, I felt...
I did love it, but I do remember thinking at the time I wished it had been called Peace and Peace, because I much preferred the peace bits to the war bits. I must admit they bogged me down a bit. Whereas the social parts, the family, that those were wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I thought both of those pictures were absolutely brill, and I haven't read either of those books, so I would happily go and pick them both up. Lissa, the fact that you sort of reread The Shipping News 6 times and that you got something more out of it, or you certainly, more surprises on the second and third reading, the fact that it's so stuffed with stories, really makes me think, gosh, there must be so much from
It's funny, there's another aspect to it, because my mum absolutely loved it, and she used to read it once a year just for Christmas. So when I read it, I feel like I'm having a conversation with my mum, who's long gone. But, you know, so it's always nice sharing that as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Sharing books across the generations.
Absolutely.
That's really
very
nice.
Special, isn't it? Yeah.
And then with your pitch, Vic, with War and Peace, you know, you started by saying you've got to get the right translation, and I've recently been reading a lot of books in translation for the International Booker Prize, and you know, I couldn't agree with you more about how important it is.
Absolutely,
to get,
I mean, their names should be on the front cover of every single book they translate, because you know their labours to do. It's not just saying, you know, this word equals this word. The way they have to really reach into the meaning. I mean, I think for literary fiction, it's absolutely extraordinary how translators
absolutely.
Work.
And for humour as well. I remember hearing what was her name? Was it Angela Simpson? Ignore this bit. But I remember hearing a translator talk and trying to get the jokes for the Asterix books. She not only did serious translations, but she also did Asterix translations.
I think it's almost a skill in some cases higher than the writing itself, I think, you know, to lift a sentence and turn it into a different language and get it right.
Bell. I've just remembered her name. Sorry, Anthea Bell is the translator.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, she's really, she's very feted, isn't she? And celebrated. Yeah. But
what I loved about hearing you talk about War and Peace, as you say, a title we all know and one that many have not read and always come up with excuses like you did, you know, about having the time and goodness, how blooming long is it and stuff. But it was interesting to hear you say that there's not a book that has competes with it for in terms of how it sort of weaves the story. It's got love, loss, sex, death, humour. I didn't know that
humour. Well, again, I don't know whether Anthony Briggs brought this out, but Tolstoy writes with kind of irony about a lot of his characters, and you know he's sort of teasing them for the way they're behaving. He's not just sort of narrating their actions. He's going, you know, it's just the little twists. So there are lots of places where I laughed out loud, and because, you know, the family were all together in the same house, you go, what are you laughing at, Mum? War and Peace. And nobody sort of expected this. And the other thing that, again, because I was a sort of bit of a Philistine and hadn't read it, the chapters are incredibly short, so you can just read it for half an hour. You know, the length of the book, it's subdivided into chapters and then parts, so it's got these sort of main acts and then volumes. So you could arguably read part one and then put it to a side and pick it up again a few weeks later, but I really didn't want to do that because it does have a great sort of flow. And the other thing in this edition, The Penguin, which I hugely value now, is that there's a précis of every single chapter. So you can quickly whiz through.
Oh, that's good.
And it's literally one line. It's literally the key thing that happens in that chapter. You know, Nikolai ends up owing 43,000 rubles. And that's enough to jog my memory of what happened in volume two, part one,
exactly,
chapter 14.
Yeah.
So it's very, very easy to sort of work your way around. And, of course, it has a lovely ribbon, which, you know, to have a ribbon in a book, oh, it's lovely. So you're not returning. I love a ribbon. Don't you love a ribbon, Lisa?
Oh, I love a ribbon. Or even two. Yes, yes.
Two. I could have done with two.
Oh, two. Yeah. You're getting spoilt with two, aren't you? Yeah. But I loved both of your pictures. And as I said, I want to read both of these books. And I've got to pick one, you know, to take home based on the pitch. That's how it works. And do you know what? I didn't think I would do this, but I'm going to take War and Peace home.
I knew it.
I knew it.
Don't drop it on your foot.
No, gosh. But also, I don't think I've ever really been that fussed about it. But hearing you talk about it for those 3 minutes has actually really made me want to read it. So I think that is...
That's good.
That was a really good job. But
fair
also,
dues.
Nissa,
fair dues.
I want to read the shipping news.
I definitely want to read
and that's
that.
Not... I'm not copping out. I genuinely am. I think that sounds fascinating.
I thought Vic did beautifully.
Well, I thought you did, and I now feel that I'm going to download
loving.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, see, we started with a loving and we're ending with which is nice, isn't it?
Totally genuine.
One August Night by Victoria Hislop is out now and it's published by Headline. And V for Victory by Lissa Evans is also out now, published by Doubleday. Both fab reads, and we suggest getting yourself a copy to fill your shelves. Thank you both so much for your wonderful pictures and your recommendations and for chatting about your books. It's been lovely spending 45 minutes with you, and I hope we get to do it in person again very soon.
Nice. Thank you, George. Pleasure.
We'll definitely be there, won't we, Lissa? And next time,
yes,
you'll win the competition.
Yeah, we'll do it with a drink in our hand. We'll see how that changes
good.
Things.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.